All right, so here we are into chapter 23. These religious leaders here in verse 1, they cannot enforce the death penalty themselves, so they need the Roman governor to help them do this. So their whole assembly rose up and brought him before Pilate. I don't know. I thought about this week. This is kind of crazy that's the first line that we read, is that they brought him before Pilate. If you remember all the way back to Jesus, what we would call the triumphal entry, as he comes into the city of Jerusalem. This was only 5 or 6 days ago in the text, right? He rides into Jerusalem on this donkey, and what did they all want him to do? They all expected that he would ride into town straight to the palace where the Roman governors and authorities were, and that he would start to clean house, right? They wanted him to take out the government and install himself as the king. And now the very person that they hoped Jesus would take out, they are now going to for permission to take Jesus out. It's kind of wild. So Pilate, he is the Roman governor responsible for finances in the region and maintaining law and order. And normally the religious leaders would have had to travel to another city for this whole thing to find him, but he happens to be in town for the Passover to help maintain the peace, because there's a lot of people in the city during this holiday. And you're going to see as we go along how Pilate's desire for and his job description of maintaining the peace, you're going to see how that plays into this story as we go along. So he's here in Jerusalem. So since the Jews want Jesus killed, they have to provide evidence against Jesus in such a way that it's going to catch Pilate's attention, right? They have to make Jesus look like a political threat so that Pilate is able to put Jesus right where they want him. And so as the self-appointed prosecution here, here's their case against Jesus, verse 2. They began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation, opposing payment of taxes to Caesar, saying that he is the Messiah, the king." So here's the first thing. We found this man misleading our nation. I think this is their way of saying, we have nothing to do with this guy, all right? Just so you know, we found him like this. He didn't come up from our teaching. He wasn't one of us. He is in no way tied to us. We found him talking like this, and what he's doing is perverting our nation. He's twisting the truth. He's lying to people. So we found him misleading our nation. Secondly, we found him opposing payment of taxes to Caesar. Is that true? No, that's not true at all. If you were here with us back when we studied Luke chapter 20, verse 25, Jesus said, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's." These same religious leaders ask him point blank, "So should we pay taxes to Caesar?" And he's like, "Well, whose face is on the coin? Caesar's? Okay, well then pay your taxes." So this is patently false. He doesn't oppose taxes at all. But in the religious leader's mind, since Pilate is in charge of finances, this accusation means, hey, Pilate, you know it will reflect poorly on you if you lose money because you let this guy who opposes taxes live. You know, this guy's a financial risk to you. You better do something about this. So that's their second accusation. Third, and he is saying that he himself is the Messiah, a king. And again, that word king is meant to catch Pilate's attention. It's trying to ruffle his feathers and make Jesus sound like he's a revolutionary. Pilate, he's coming for your throne. He's coming for your job. Again, you better take him seriously. And that one must have at least caught Pilate's attention, because in verse 3, so Pilate asked him, "So are you the king of the Jews? Is this true?" And Jesus answered him, "You say so." Jesus doesn't really say, "Yes, that's correct. I am a king." Because Pilate's view of what it means to be a king is different than Jesus' view of what it means to be the king. Pilate's mind would go to armies and power and land. And from an earthly standpoint, Jesus has none of those. So in Pilate's mind, Jesus really isn't that big of a threat to Rome. He's not really all that intimidating. And besides that, if he is really the king of the Jews, then to kill him in a city full of Jewish people is probably a bad idea. He's not worth disturbing the peace. And so verse 4, Pilate then told the chief priests and the crowds, I don't find any grounds for charging this man. But they kept insisting, but he stirs up the people, teaching all throughout Judea from Galilee where he started, even to here. And now this is them saying to Pilate, but listen, this isn't some guy riding his 10 minutes of fame here in Jerusalem just because there's a lot of people around. He's been doing this all over the region. This isn't just a city thing, Pilate. This is everywhere that your authority goes, he's been doing this. He's been stirring people up. You are insane if you let him walk. Verse 6, when Pilate heard this, he asked if the man was a Galilean. Finding that he was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem during those days. Now, we learned back in chapter 3, verse 1, that Herod is another ruler, and his title is Tetrarch. And Tetrarch means he's a ruler of a quarter. I don't know if that's exactly 1/4, but it means that he rules part of an area. And so Pilate would have been the governor of the whole region, and Herod served under him, overseeing some of that area. This is Herod Antipas, which is the same Herod that put John the Baptist in prison, later killed him. This Herod is also about a fourth Jewish, so he likes to think of himself as the king of the Jews, something not a single Jewish person agreed with him about. Herod was responsible for overseeing the region of Galilee, where Jesus did most of his ministry, and he too was in Jerusalem for the Passover, probably in the same palace complex that Pilate was. So it was a very short walk over to where he was, so Pilate sent Jesus over. Now, if you remember what Lucy read down in verse 12, Pilate and Herod up to this point didn't get along very well. So maybe Jesus being sent over to Herod is out of spite. We don't know why Pilate sent him over. It doesn't really matter, but maybe Pilate just wants to push the decision off to somebody else so he doesn't look like the bad guy. Whatever the reason, Herod was very thankful, verse 8, that Jesus got sent over to him, because for a long time he had wanted to see him. He heard a lot about him and was hoping to see a miracle performed by him. So Herod was not the first person, though, who wanted to be entertained by Jesus. Back in chapter 4, we saw Jesus going into his own hometown, and his own hometown was like, you know, they wanted to see him do something. And he said, yeah, no doubt you're going to ask me to do something here, but it's not really about the signs so much. They wanted to see signs, but they weren't really interested in him. They just wanted to be entertained. I did a little bit of research this week, and one of the longest running shows in Las Vegas is the Penn and Teller show. We still love being entertained by things that seem otherworldly, right? We still love to be mesmerized by things that we go, how did you do that? If someone in your community group said, hey, I've been practicing some magic tricks or some card tricks or something, you wouldn't say, oh, that's cool. You'd be like, prove it. I want to see one. Show me. I want to see if you're any good at it. You know, practice on us, right? We love stuff like that. And I'm guessing in verse 9, that's what Herod keeps pestering Jesus about. Come on, they said you can do stuff. Let's go do something. But Jesus, verse 9, did not answer him. Isaiah 53, that same chapter that tells us about Jesus' suffering, also tells us that Jesus would be silent in this moment. Said, like a sheep, like a lamb led to the slaughter, like a sheep is silent before her shearers, Jesus did not open his mouth. And so even in this moment, he is fulfilling prophecies that were made 700 years earlier. But an important piece of Jesus being silent here is that it puts 100% of the blame for his crucifixion on the people who are begging for it. This is important. Jesus does not talk his way into being crucified. He's not making bold statements. He's not trying to defend himself. He just silently waits for the inevitable. And the religious leaders aren't here for the show like Herod is. So verse 10, the chief priests and the scribes stood by vehemently accusing him. Are you noticing the progression of these chief priests? Right? First they were just accusing. Now then they were insisting. Now they're vehemently accusing him, and they're not done. But they're getting aggressive now because Pilate and Herod are not cooperating with them. They need them to stamp the death sentence, and they won't do it. They won't do it, so they're getting frustrated. But Herod is frustrated too, because after waiting to see Jesus for so long, he's not getting what he wants. He wants a miracle. Jesus won't do it, won't even talk. And so verse 11, then Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt. They mocked him, they dressed him in bright clothing, and they sent him back to Pilate. Fine, get out of here, Jesus. If you don't perform for me when I ask you to, then you're of no use to me. Just be gone. And I read that this week, and I'm going to step out on a limb here and say that I think it would be safe to say that at some point for all of us in our lives, we, like Herod, have found Jesus to be a bit of a disappointment. Can we admit that together? Can we admit that there have been times where we, like Herod, have found Jesus to be a bit of a disappointment? Jesus, I appreciate the grace. I really do. I really do appreciate the grace. But actually, what I need right now is a raise. Actually, what I need is a surprise suitcase full of 50s on my porch. And instead of getting that, we continue to scrape by or live paycheck to paycheck. And I don't understand why I always have to be stressed about finances. The grace is nice, but really what I need is help on finances, and I don't see you coming through on it. Jesus, I appreciate you dying for my sin. I really do. But actually, I'm doing okay right now. What I actually need from you right now is for you to work on my spouse, work on my kids, work on my boss, work on my landlord, work on my neighbor. And it seems like praying about it really isn't helping. It just continues actually to get worse. You're not changing them at all. And I appreciate you dying for my sin, but that's not actually what I need most right now. Or Jesus, I know you talk a lot about the kingdom of heaven here on earth and you care about what's in my heart and all of that, but what I really need for you right now is for all of the things on my daily planner to go perfectly today. Because if all of the things go really well today, then I can do all of the things that I have on the schedule for tomorrow that'll go well. And I have to do those so that by the weekend, I can get these projects in order, because next month we have to move the thing here and bring the other thing in here, and we're not going to be able to get to do that. And then we're not going to be able to put the patio in and then do all of this so that next year we can sit by the fire and relax with people. And yet, I've got all of these things that need to be done, that need to fall into place, and I keep getting interrupted. I can't get the supplies I need. We bumped the timeline 3 times already, and I'm just not sure you're as concerned about this as I am. You don't seem to be answering my prayers, and it's weird to me because we're doing all of this for you anyway. Anybody been there on any of those? Those are all 3 from my own journal, so I'm sure you could add your own to those, where we look at Jesus and say, what I really need from you is a miracle, a sign. Herod wanted a show from Jesus and he didn't get it. So he sent him back to Pilate. And that very day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Previously, they'd been enemies. Luke doesn't tell us why, but I'm guessing what brought about their friendship here was that they both stood in positions of authority. They saw this situation the same way. They both agreed Jesus was innocent, but neither of them released him. Neither one of them used their authority to break up the crowd and say, listen, this is over, get out of here. And because they didn't do that, it makes them both accomplices in Jesus' death, which also fulfills scripture. And you see this in Acts chapter 4. The apostle Peter was praying one time and he said this: in this city, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, in other words, everybody, assembled together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, to do whatever your hand and your will had predestined to take place. And so Peter sees Herod and Pilate as complicit in the death of Jesus, but he sees it all as part of God the Father guiding these events with his hand, guiding these events with his will to make sure that his son is crushed for the sins of all who would believe. So back to Pilate for round two. Here we go, verse 13. Pilate called together the chief priests, the leaders, and the people, and he said to them, "You brought me this man as one who misleads the people. But in fact, after examining him in your presence, I have found no grounds to charge this man with the things you accuse him of. Neither is Herod, because he sent him back to us. Clearly, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will have him whipped and then release him. That way you guys will be happy because I rough him up a little bit. He'll think twice before he goes out preaching again. And I don't cause a riot because he doesn't die. So let's try to get on with things." In the actual timeline of events here, according to the other gospel accounts, it would appear that the religious leaders are having none of this. They will not be satisfied with Jesus just getting a beating. They want him dead. Pilate starts to realize he's losing control of this whole thing. And so he tries something new. In Matthew chapter 27, verse 15, it tells us that there was an annual tradition that Pilate would release one prisoner every Passover. And so the people, the Jewish people, could discuss among themselves, figure out who it was that they wanted, someone that had been arrested and put in prison for whatever reason. They could talk it over. Pilate would grant the pardon and release him. And it just so happens there is a Jewish guy in prison whose last name is Barabbas. And when we put the gospel accounts together, we learn this man is a fighter. He's a murderer. Matthew's gospel calls him a notorious prisoner. Verse 19 here in Luke 23 says he was thrown into prison for rebellion and for murder. A Jewish person who murders someone in a rebellion means that he is actually in prison for the things they're accusing Jesus of. Stirring up trouble in their, they're not accusing Jesus of murder, but of stirring up trouble in the region, speaking out against Caesar, those kind of things. Barabbas is in prison for doing the things they're accusing Jesus of doing. And again, after some study this week, the name Barabbas means son of the father. That's how we know it was his last name. That means son of the father. And after working through this again with some other, with looking at Matthew and some footnotes, it seems the reason that he's referred to by his last name here, Barabbas, is because some early manuscripts of the Bible include his first name, which is also the Jewish name Yeshua or Jesus. And so if that's true, then according to Matthew's account, Pilate pulls Jesus Barabbas out of prison and puts him next to Jesus the Christ and says, "Which Jesus do you want me to release? The one who actually has stirred up the people against Rome and against Caesar, the one who actually wants to make himself powerful, or the one who hasn't? Which one do you want?" And I think this is Pilate's clever way of going, "All right, do you guys really care about Caesar? Do you really care about Rome? Do you really care if the peace is disturbed? If so, you would never release this guy because he's guilty of those very things." So Pilate presents Jesus the murderer and Jesus the king. And in verse 18 of Luke 23, they all cried out together, "Take this man away and release Barabbas to us." Well, that's not what Pilate was hoping for, verse 20. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate addressed them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify, crucify him." There's been a lot of movies and stuff made about Jesus' life and death, so you've probably seen a lot of different depictions of crucifixion. But crucifixion was one of the harshest forms of capital punishment in the ancient world. The whole purpose of crucifixion was to cause a brutal enough scene publicly that anybody who was thinking about a crime would think twice, right? You do not want to go out like that. Basically, this kind of death was for rebels and slaves and foreigners who were executed like this. The actual death itself came by suffocation through exhaustion or loss of blood. And that was what the crowd was demanding that Jesus must go through. To qualify for crucifixion, though, you had to be found guilty of either treason or evading due process in a murder trial. Those two things. And so a third time here in verse 22, Pilate pleads with the crowd, why do I need to crucify him? What has he done wrong? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him whipped and release him. That's what I'm going to do. But verse 23, here's the continuing progression. But they kept up the pressure, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified, and their voices won out. This is mob rule, right? And so Pilate probably figured by now, look, it's just better to not have a riot here at the hands of these people. Let's just kill this one guy and be done with this. So verse 24, Pilate grants what they want. He releases Barabbas and hands Jesus over to their will. And just like that, the innocent is treated like a criminal, and the convicted criminal is set free. The king trades places with the prisoner. The convicted and the condemned walks while the sinless is sentenced to die. This scene is so powerfully a picture of the gospel that I pray you do not miss this today. I pray that you do not miss this. Barabbas was in prison paying the penalty for the record that stood against him. He was not brought up out of prison because he was on good behavior and he was up for a review. He was not brought up out of prison because he'd been doing well. When he woke up that morning, he was a condemned criminal, and maybe before breakfast, all of a sudden he had been set free because another man stood in his place. Another man was condemned for the sin of Barabbas. I hope you're already way ahead of me on this, but we're going to go there anyway. We're going here anyway. The good news of Jesus always has to start with the bad news. And the bad news is more tragic than we would ever admit to. Just like, I know it's not football season, but here's my analogy. Just like an entire football team pays the price for one lineman's penalty for holding or whatever. Just like the whole team pays for that one person's penalty, the whole human race was penalized for Adam's sin in the Garden of Eden. Because he rebelled against God, just like Barabbas, anyone who would be born from Adam and Eve's family, all of us, would be born with rebellion in our blood. In other words, this is big for us to understand. When you were born guilty of Adam's rebellion. Okay? When you were born guilty of his rebellion. Here's how we know that. Romans 5, verse 12. Therefore, sin entered the world through one man, and in this way, death spread to all people. Why? Because all sinned. In his one death, all of us sinned. We're all born guilty of Adam's sin, born spiritually dead. That's exactly why a person can look you in the face and say, but I'm a good person. I just try to be good. I try to do what I can. I try to be good to others. I give where I can. I'm trying to just do good where I'm. Yeah, well, according to Isaiah 64, when you try to be a good person, but you don't let Jesus run your life, your good works are just polishing your own casket. You might as well be saying, I know I'm dead in sin, but I'm trying to be a good corpse. I'm doing the best I can. That's the problem. That's the problem. That's the bad news. But then, whether it was through a sermon or a conversation or a song or a dream or some interaction, whatever it was, the Spirit of God shows up on your porch unannounced and opens your eyes to see what Jesus has done. And when he does, he opens your eyes to see that what Jesus has done is that he's changed places with you. He willingly allows himself to be condemned for the crimes you committed. Not because you were a good prisoner with good behavior and he wanted to do you a favor, but because from the foundation of the world, Ephesians 1 says, he chose you to be holy and blameless in love before him. He predestined you to be adopted as sons through Jesus Christ for himself. Why? According to the good pleasure of his will. To the praise of his glorious grace that he lavished on us in Jesus. It was the eternal plan of your heavenly Father that it would be by grace you are brought from death to life. By grace you would be saved. By grace you would be set free. And then Romans 5 goes on to say that in the same way that one man's sin brought judgment and death into the whole world, that's Adam, also through one man's obedience. Even when that obedience meant willingly enduring a brutally punishing death on the cross and having God the Father turn his back on him, through one man's obedience, the many are made no longer guilty. Not guilty anymore. After this exchange with Jesus, Barabbas could walk down the middle of the street and a whole bunch of people could be walking. He could go anywhere he wanted. People might have said, oh man, I remember that guy and what he used to be like. I remember him. Man, remember how he used to stir up the people? Remember how he killed people? Remember how he was always fighting? They can sit there and reminisce all day about what Barabbas used to be like. But if they go to the courthouse and pull up his record, all they'll find is that it's been wiped clean, as if he never killed anyone, never participated in a rebellion, never sentenced in the court of law. There's nothing there. He's free and clear. Jesus took Barabbas' record on himself. And again, that's the gospel. Again, it's the gospel. People can look at you and say, oh man, I remember what she was like in high school. I remember what he was like in college. I remember, and I love what 1 Corinthians 6 verse 11 says about that. 1 Corinthians 6 lists off this whole list of these sins, of all of the things that could be done. And 1 Corinthians 11 goes, yeah, some of you were like that. Some of you used to be like that. You were accused and found guilty of doing some pretty disgusting and rebellious things. Or someone did some pretty disgusting and rebellious things to you. Then he says, but you were washed. You were sanctified. You were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God. You used to be that. That's not you anymore. The gospel frees us up to say, oh man, the things you heard about me in high school, you didn't even hear half of it. It's way worse than what you heard. It's way worse than what you think. But that's not me anymore. Jesus showed up. I've been washed. I've been given new clothes to wear. I've been given a new name. That old me died, and what you're looking at is a new creation washed in the blood of Christ. Say whatever you want about how I got into prison. I remember those days all too well. But if you want to dog me about who I am, you're going to have to do it from memory because my record is clean. And if you get to the courtroom of heaven and you look into my folder to see the record against me, you're going to see a sticky note that says, see Jesus. And everything in my folder was applied to him and everything in his folder was applied to me. There is no condemnation anymore, not now, not ever. That's the gospel. Anybody excited about that at all? Okay. It's the good news. It's the reason we gather together on Sundays. It's the reason we sing. It's the reason we pray. It's the reason we put effort into our marriages and our parenting. It's the reason we strive to be sexually holy. It's the reason we're attempting to put a cafe downtown. It's the reason we teach our young people truth in Kid City and don't just play games with them for 45 minutes. It's the reason we get up to read our Bibles. It's the reason we forgive people who've wronged us. It's the reason we rejoice when we suffer various kinds of trials. It's the reason we endure persecution. It's the reason we plant churches and partner with others. It's why we open our homes and our tables to strangers. It's why we give away our money as if we don't need it anymore. It's why we go crazy when somebody gets baptized. This is what we're being told every time we pick up the bread and the cup for the Lord's Supper, is that we did nothing, Jesus did everything. And all that's left for us to do is act on that freedom to enjoy and delight in the person who stood in for us, to praise him, to live for him, and to know him. That's what's left for us. Normally, right here, I would give you a couple things to pray about and confess to the Lord, but today we're going to sing first. So let's stand. We're going to sing this celebration song together that our rescuer has come and that we are free. So let's sing it out together. Of Barabbas is such a tiny little blip in the story of Jesus, right? The story of Barabbas, like literally it's his 5 minutes of fame. It's just this little blip, and then he's gone. If you've ever seen Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, I love how this scene is portrayed. Because Barabbas thinks the crowd has come to rescue him. They think his people have shown up for him. The Jews are calling his name. It's like, man, I'm big time. They knew I was in prison. My people have come for me. They demanded my freedom. He let me walk. Power to the people. Right? This is what he thinks. But in the movie, Barabbas rushes down the steps from Pilate's courtroom, and he runs into the crowd expecting hugs and high fives and love. And basically everyone pushes him away with disgust. They don't want him. They never did. This wasn't about him. And then his story ends with a question mark or a dot, dot, dot. We have no idea what happened to him. Have no idea if, did Barabbas find himself alone in his house one night going, wait a minute, what actually happened there? What was that? Did he happen to walk out to the hill called Golgotha later that day, where that same Jesus who stood next to him on the platform now hangs on a cross? He certainly would have experienced the same earthquake, the same darkness in the middle of the day that everyone else did. Did Barabbas ever make the connection? Did he ever think about his fellow prisoners and think, why me? Of all of the people there, why me? Did he ever put the pieces together that Jesus died for the things he was guilty of? And our question for all of us today is, have you? Have you ever put the pieces together that Jesus died for the things you are guilty of?